your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasoline. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now your host, Rick Moore.
Yeehaw! Welcome, boys and girls, to the Sunday morning wake-up call here on WNRN. We got all kinds of stuff going on today here in the studio. Lazarus with us again. He's awfully entertained by what's going on in the studio. Lots of smells for a hound dog. Deepak pulling off his first solo production show. Feel free when you call up today throughout the hour. Say hi to Deepak. Michael Strickland moving on to New York University. Rusty, I don't know, usually hangs around for the hour, but today he's got things to do. And we want to make sure and thank Lynchburg's 89.9 listeners for being here with us. And let me take a moment and thank Blue Ridge Graphics for their support during the hour. You can find them at Meade Avenue and East High Street here in Charlottesville, providing custom t-shirts and sportswear, plus promotional items for schools, organizations, and businesses. That's Blue Ridge Graphics. 296-9746, and online at brgtshirts.com. All right, let's welcome Al Weed into the studio. Mr. Weed, how are you today?
I'm fine, Rick. It's good to be here.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a while since we've had you around.
Yes, it has.
And the last time you were here, I think we were talking political stuff.
Well, we are today, too, but in a different form.
In a different form. Instead
yes.
of your personal political issues and items on the list, we're going to talk mainly about one particular one that you have a, well, I guess everyone has a vested interest in carbon emissions, don't they?
I hope so.
Al Weed, chairman of Public Policy Virginia, in the studio. Write down the phone number because you're going to want to call us up later in the hour. Stretch out those finger muscles that only one pulling a thumb. 979-0919. And if you are down in the other areas, the Lynchburg that we mentioned, or Harrisonburg, Lexington, Richmond, those new Lovingston folks, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS, chairman of Public Policy Virginia. What is that organization? What do you do?
I'll start out by commenting on the irony that this show, which will be all about, we hope, carbon emissions, being sponsored by Tiger Fuel. But I know how it is in nonprofit radio.
You careful, get it, careful you? Now.
We are an organization dedicated to raising awareness at the grassroots level of important public policy issues. We are dedicated to communicating the concerns that we all should have about climate change, and also providing tools to people, again, at the grassroots level to have an impact on public policy. We all know personally what we can do about energy usage and make some contributions to slowing global warming, but the next step and the most important step is to get public policy change to embolden, if you will, our political leaders to take the steps that we need to, if not reverse, climate change or the move toward global warming, at least to slow it down so that there's something left for our children and grandchildren.
And who started this organization and how long has it been around?
It was started in 2005. A woman named Diana Abbott and I began it when, after my first run for political office, I realized, counter to my idealistic ideas, that you could talk about real, again, ideas in a political campaign, I found that that's not the case. People aren't prepared in the context of vote for me, vote for him, to think about ideas. So I realized if we were ever going to move forward any progressive political or progressive public policy, we had to be talking about it in a non-political environment. So we started Public Policy Virginia to deal with two basic ideas. In the first chapter, if you will, of the life of this organization, we talked about universal health care and we talked about biofuels. Now, we're not talking about universal health care anymore, not because it's not important and vital to the health of this nation, but because others are talking about it quite vigorously. I think it will be a key element in this presidential campaign. So we're focusing more on biofuels and biomass as a response to global warming, and we're dealing with the public policy implications of how we approach global warming.
All right. Well, you mentioned earlier that we are going to talk about carbon emissions. Define that for me. I mean, I think people are familiar with global warming, but not necessarily carbon emissions as a two-word phrase.
I think the simplest way to visualize this is what's called a closed cycle and an open cycle. In a closed cycle carbon situation, you take wood, if you will, and you burn it in your fireplace to heat your home, and the carbon dioxide that is in that cellulosic material is released into the atmosphere. That carbon dioxide goes up and becomes part of the atmosphere, but the next tree that is burned to replace the wood you just, I mean, that is growing to replace the wood you just burned, absorbs that carbon dioxide and restores it or sequesters it so that you have a balance. That's the closed cycle. When you are burning fossil fuels, which are primarily oil, petroleum, and coal, you're releasing carbon that has been sequestered for millions of years, and you're releasing that into the air, and there's no recapturing of it. So it stores in the air, in the atmosphere. And the reason it's a greenhouse gas, there are a lot of complex physics about it, Rick, but the reason that it's vital is carbon dioxide freed this way from fossil fuels lasts in the atmosphere for 100 years. It doesn't just fall out the way some other pollutants might. And so we have seen an increase in the parts per million in the atmosphere from, well, under 200 parts per million, or maybe it's billion, parts per billion in the atmosphere, up to now we're in the range of 300. And there are many who feel that this is a sort of a tipping point. We may not be able to come back from it.
Now, you mentioned how it's sort of ironic for one of the companies underwriting this program to be a show sponsor. But I guess what I need to know is, okay, so you've told me why they're bad and told everyone who's listening today. By the way, Al Weed here from Public Policy Virginia, as we talk about carbon emissions and how they last for 100 years. And I know how they're bad, why they're bad. But what's the how have they increased at such a rapid level? Where were they 100 years ago, if they existed at all, to where they are now, 2008? Because I guess the word that I'm getting is slow, 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 fast, fast, fast. Whoa, out of control.
Well, think about it this way, Rick. 100 years ago, very little of the world relative to today was industrialized, and we were using much less energy per capita as individuals, even in the most industrialized.
Is it all a fossil fuel thing?
It's all a fossil fuel thing. It is almost entirely a fossil fuel thing. The reason being, well, there are other greenhouse gases, methane, for example, which comes from
cow farms and pig farms.
Yeah, there are other sources of greenhouse gases, but in the sort of pre-1960s world, they were in balance. We hadn't reached a tipping point. And I'm not sure if we've reached that tipping point yet, but I fear that we have.
Define tipping point for me.
All right.
I mean, obviously, I can envision the scale in my hand, sort of that, and I had this conversation with someone the other day about a different topic, but not the electronic scale, but the scale of justice, you know, the two-sided scale. What is the tipping point?
The tipping point is a phrase made popular by a New Yorker writer whose name escapes me this morning, but essentially, you reach a point in any number of circumstances where you can perhaps stop it. You can perhaps control the situation. But at some point, it falls over and you can't recapture it. Just imagine that cup of coffee on the table, and you're pounding the table, bang, 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 and you look and you realize, oh, my God, it's right on the edge. You reach for it and you miss it. That's a tipping point. Where we are now is we've had a couple of factors, significant factors. First is the rapid increase and geometric increase in the use of energy. And while nuclear power, which is a non-greenhouse gas producing power, has grown over the years, it has nowhere near kept up with coal and petroleum, which do release carbon, as I've described. Moreover, you have a increased world population and the destruction of forest, rainforest, and other forested areas that are vital to capturing CO2 out of the air and re-sequestering it. So we've lost that capability. But probably the most interesting most interesting way to describe this, Rick, is to look at what's happening in California today. The wildfire is completely out of control. Well, not completely. It sounds like maybe they're getting them under control.
It's been weeks.
It's been weeks. Those wildfires have been exacerbated by the dryness. Every climate observer recognizes that the dryness has to do with global warming and that it is one of the hallmarks of global warming. That dryness makes wildfires more dangerous, more voracious, if you will. And then after those forests have been burned, we've lost the ability to recapture CO2 from the air because we've lost those growing trees. So we've not only burned them and put the CO2 in the air, adding to the greenhouse gases, we don't have a way to recapture that. We're not in balance. And those are what are called negative feedback loops as well. I mean, things just get worse, not better, when you get there. And if you combine all these negative feedback loops, you've got to wonder whether we are at a tipping point.
All right, Al Weed in the studio today as we take on the environmental topic about carbon emissions. Mr. Weed, the chairman of an organization, Public Policy Virginia, 979-0919-1877-WNRN rocks, the toll-free number. I'm certainly trying to get me the basics so I can understand where we are. If I've missed a question that you'd like to ask more of the basic level before we jump into the next grouping of questions, feel free to dial us up now. Deepak's out there ready to answer the phone, or at least he's supposed to be. Okay. Cap and trade has been something that's been in the news for the last several years. I think California is most likely where it started, at least in my mind. Explain to me what cap and trade is, because it seems like my basic, and I accuse people of this all the time, read the headline, read the first paragraph, don't bother with the remaining 24 paragraphs of an in-depth newspaper article. And I fall into this for this topic. But cap and trade seems to be an incomplete way to solve the problem from what I know about it. Please define it and jump further.
Okay, cap and trade is a sound economic policy that was proven effective in reducing pollution from power plants, not CO2, but things like sulfur dioxide and nitrous oxide. And what they did was they went into the older power plants and said, look, here's the limits that you can produce. But we recognize you've got older technology so that tomorrow you can't get down to that limit. So that if you buy the rights to pollute from other power plants that are online or are more modern, the overall pollutants will be reduced. And in fact, it worked because as my equipment wore out, I put in new, better technology, and my pollution from sulfur dioxide and these other associated pollutants dropped.
So if the total per plant is 20 and I'm making 30, I need to find somebody who's making 10.
Precisely. And that need to find, it may be easier for me to take those dollars to get somebody who's in the process of putting new equipment in and buy those pollution credits, if you will, so he has the money to put the equipment in, than it is for me to completely re-equip my power plant. But over time, and this, as you recall, became a big issue in the Bush administration about midway through its 8-year reign, where they were interpreting it not requiring power plants to make the changes when they put in new equipment. But the whole point behind cap and trade is that there is an incentive, both a legal incentive and an economic incentive, to put in the best technology you can to reduce it, and it worked. Sulfur dioxide and nitrous oxide from typical coal-fired plants have been reduced dramatically as a result of that. The problem is it's not a good model for CO2 or for greenhouse gases, and it's not a good model for two reasons. The first is that the difficulty of enforcing cap-and-trade is one that will create a massive bureaucracy. But more significantly, the issue of greenhouse gases is a global issue. With sulfur dioxide and the other point pollutants, they were basically local. We in Virginia were getting the sulfur dioxide, nitrous oxide, from power plants in Ohio. When that got controlled, we stopped getting them. Things are down. If every power plant in the United States were to reduce its carbon dioxide emissions through cap and trade, the Chinese and the Indians and third world power demanding countries would continue to pollute the air with CO2, we would not get where we need to go. So cap and trade, while it economically works in a global economy, won't work in my view.
I'm curious, before we jump sort of into what's happening in China and in India, how easy or difficult would it be for an industry, a factory, whatever, to actually get under the current regulations rather than continuing to buy the amounts that they can get from someone else, even if you don't view it in a global setting?
Well, the idea with cap and trade is that over time, the amount of CO2 that a particular operation, and just as an aside, cap and trade does not in any significant way get to the pollutants put out by our oil-burning cars. It's largely coal-fired and coal-fired power plants and industries that are going to pay the price. Over time, the amount of CO2 emissions allowed will decrease. So it's going to be harder and harder for each of these emitters to meet the increasingly stringent CO2 standards. And the idea is that they can look ahead and say, in a carbon-constrained economy, we must put in the equipment. We must find ways to reduce the CO2. It is hoped that this will push coal-burning plants into carbon sequestration technology that will mean that we can still produce energy from coal, but we won't be putting out the greenhouse gases. That's the theory. It's not clear that it'll work, but it's better than nothing, which is what we have now.
But you said earlier that the current administration has sort of, I guess, backed off. And so I'm curious as to how those not in compliance are really ever forced to do so. I mean, because we're not lowering. Again, I go back to my made up numbers of, if my plant puts out 30 and your plant puts out 10 and the medium is 20, then we're still, you know, we're still meeting the 40 that is typically asked for.
But take those numbers. The 40 is what we're asking for today.
From two plants.
The 40 is what we're asking from today. But you as a producer of carbon emissions also know that under whatever regulation we're talking about, it's going to be 30 next year.
Is it?
And it's going to be 27 the year after.
But aren't we talking about numbers that are like 2050?
Well,
in 2050, in which case we'll have at least, and I can't do the math that fast in my head, but at least four other administrations between now and then, some of whom can be as disinterested in this type of topic and these concerns as some of our recent others have been.
Well, I think you put your finger on it, Rick, that as serious as this is for the future of climate as we understand it and our position as humans on the earth, politicians have been just sort of blasé about it. And this administration especially has ignored the science of its own government, and just this week said that they're not going to do anything about greenhouse gases. It's largely political and responsive to a certain perceived base. But we can only hope that as the world wakes up, as the United States wakes up and realizes that without our leadership in this issue, not much is going to happen, that we as a nation will pull together behind this. This administration's failure to execute the law obviously is not just in the environmental area, but it's throughout. They've put their own political spin on what the law is, and at some point they have to be called to task for it. That's what we have elections for. But that's also what we have Congress for, to say, wait a minute, you guys are not enforcing the law as we passed it. And hopefully over time we will get away from that kind of executive authority.
And for those who may be concerned that this is becoming a political show, I'm sure that we can reach back before 2000 and say that there are plenty of other administrations who had an opportunity to do something to become the initial leaders on this topic and who also failed to do so.
Well, I think every political environment, every political administration is under pressure from people who want to see change, who have a vision of where we could be or where we might be if we don't change, and others who have a stake in the present. And it's politics is just a balance between those. And our goal, frankly, at Public Policy Virginia is to make people more aware of what is at stake and why it's important that we move ahead on this.
Al Weed from Public Policy Virginia, the chairman of the organization, as we talk about carbon emissions today, an important environmental topic for everyone who's listening. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. If you'd like to call up and ask a question or make your comments, otherwise feel free to just sit around and listen to us chat about let me ask my questions and take on Al's expertise. Right now it is 11:22 on the wake-up call. The markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Mostly sunny, but a 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms today. Highs 85 to 90, just a little bit higher in Lynchburg and Richmond. Showers and thunderstorms tonight, lows 65 to 70. And then mostly cloudy with some showers and thunderstorms tomorrow, where the highs will be 85 to 90. Right now in the valley, 84, 78 in Lynchburg, 79 in Richmond, and a delicious 78 here in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And let's thank an organization called Alt Energy of Charlottesville for designing and installing solar energy systems in Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Alt Energy solar systems now practical and reliable and can pay for themselves in a few years while reducing your carbon footprint. You can also make a difference by signing on with Alt Energy Virginia. More is at altenergyincorporated.com. And listener support goes out there to Molly Kroll, Tatiana Patton, and Brenda Clement Jones, who supported us in the fund drive this past spring. It's because of them, as well as program underwriters like the ones you're hearing from this hour, and Ragazzi's and Crossroads Music and Movies. So stay tuned. Tell a friend about the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call and the other programming you enjoy on WNRN, and be sure to support us this upcoming fall fundraiser. All right, back with Al Weed and Lazarus, who's wandered into the studio. Lazarus, anything to say? Not at the moment. All right, back with Al. Al, you mentioned how this administration had not just recently this week done anything about carbon emissions. Is that in reference to the G8 summit that was taking place?
Well, the G8 summit was I think, a disappointment to many of the European leaders who were there, who had hoped to get a more forceful statement about carbon emission reduction goals on a worldwide basis, at least for the industrialized countries. President Bush fought that kicking and screaming, and they came out with some more positive statements about where we might be going, but very, very vague nevertheless. But the president came home and then just this week basically said that the EPA will not be enforcing carbon limits. This is a man who ran in 2000 saying that he would do something about CO2.
Why wouldn't he ask the EPA to enforce that?
He claims that the impact on economics, the economy, would be such that it would be bad for everyone if we did something about CO2 emissions. It's been pretty much the administration's position all along, in spite of the laws to the contrary. And I don't understand that. I mean, we have seen an increase in oil gasoline prices from under $2 to, I just pumped this morning, $4.04 of low-grade gas into my car. And all of that money has gone overseas and not back into our economy, or all of that increase at any rate. So the idea that increasing the underlying cost of carbon would cause us to go into an economic tailspin is just bogus. The economists who have worked on this say that if we were today to set ourselves on a path to reduce carbon emissions to the level of 1990, which would be dramatic because we would be having worldwide growth, economic growth, and everything else. But if we set ourselves to do that in a serious way, the impact on the world economy would be a fraction of a percent of GNP spent on it, and might, this was 2 years ago when these predictions were made, might cause the cost of gasoline to rise by a dollar based on carbon emission controlling. We've already seen gasoline, as we know, double. Without any control, carbon emission, except what you and I don't burn because gas has gotten so expensive.
Because I walked here from Lovingston today.
Good for you. I didn't. I was running a little late. You must have started earlier. but I think that that the administration is wrong, that in an economy, the economic impact of a carbon-constrained economy, sure, it's going to hurt some people. It's going to hurt the oil companies, and it's going to hurt the coal companies. But it's going to create jobs in rural communities where biomass is being grown. It's going to create jobs in the high-tech industry where photovoltaics will take over. It's going to create jobs in the nuclear industry and in technology that can produce clean energy for a growing economy. Economic growth, there's all kinds of trade-offs. We lost the buggy makers 100 years ago. And we built an automobile industry.
But for people who've been around in this area, by the way, Al Weed from Public Policy Virginia, as we talk about carbon emissions globally, and in a minute I'm going to ask a question about more locally, people who've been around for a while recognize the name Al Weed as being the Democratic Party. And so therefore the attachment of liberal comes with that, fair or not, and I'm not sure how you view yourself. But we sit here talking about this in comparison to decisions made by a Republican administration. Are all the claims being made by scientists, by economists, about what reducing carbon emissions would or wouldn't do coming from the Democratic side, the ones that are fighting not in agreement with the current administration, and all the ones that are saying it's okay, don't worry about it, or there's nothing we can do about it, are all those coming in agreement with a Republican because they are seen as Republicans?
That's a good question. I heard a leader of the evangelical community who is probably the spokesman in the evangelical community for demanding policy dealing with global warming and climate change. I mean, they're not hewing to the so-called Republican line. I heard him ask that same question. Republicans used to be conservatives. Clearly, this is very conservative to try to do something. What's happened with the politics of this? I think there are two issues here, Rick, that are at play, especially in this year where, McCain is already apostate his own party with his backing of climate change legislation. So it's perhaps not fair to say that all Republicans are that. But I think there are two elements to it. One is that for years it has been a Democratic issue. And, you know, Al Gore and, you know, it has been an issue that Democrats have pushed harder than any other party or than the other party. And so as more and more evidence comes into play, as it becomes obvious we are in a global warming situation, it's difficult for diehard Republicans to admit that the Democrats were right, that the liberals were right, and we have to do something about it. And so it's saving face. We all get into that. You know, I don't want to admit you were right, honey, but no, you couldn't have gotten it right. You know, you just missed something. So there's that element. The other is, and this is probably more subtle but also more important, to do something about global warming, to do something about climate change, we are going to have to mobilize as a nation, and we're going to have to mobilize as a world. And in that context, I don't think anybody would deny that that means the government is going to be more on our lives than some might find comfortable. It is on the, in the equivalent of a world war. And you and I were both just little children. You may not even been born during World War II. You probably weren't.
No, thank you. I was not, for all those who call me old, who went to dinner with me last night.
Anyway, the amount of government control and rationing and other things that happened during the war, we took as a matter of course because we were faced with almost an existential threat to our nation, and we were willing to do that. I would argue and do argue on a daily basis we are faced with a similar existentialist threat, except not just to our nation but to the globe, and it will require discipline and working together, and that is something that get the government off my back Republicans are not happy with. So I think that's why we continue to have this dispute about where we go on it.
We are talking with Al Weed, Chairman of Public Policy Virginia, about carbon emissions. Dial us up, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Let me take a moment and thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for their support today. We can't do the hours without the underwriters. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports has everything you need to get outside this summer. The professional staff at your nearby local Blue Ridge Mountain Sports can help you with camping supplies, maps, guides, and even guided backpacking trips. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports can be found in the Barrack Road Shopping Center here in Charlottesville and in the Mountain Inn at Wintergreen. All right, looks like we do have a call. See, if you shout the phone number out there long enough, somebody will dial up. And Mr. Kurt?
Yes.
Ask away, sir.
Okay. I just have a comment. You know, I listen to your show. I know you try to stay away from politics and everything else, but it seems like, you know, you're dancing around a problem. You know, we need to fix the problem, not the blame. It doesn't matter whether it's, you know, global warming's not going to happen just to the Republicans or the Democrats or, you know, one religious organization or another or anything like that. You know, it's like pulling up and a car's on fire and there's someone in it and going, oh, well, are they a Republican or a Democrat? You know, I think we need to throw politics to the wind and discuss a real serious problem.
Thank you, sir. And I'll move on to that. Thanks for pointing that out, that I hadn't been a good job of asking the right questions. All right. So, Al, one of the things that you had passed on to me was something about a carbon tax. And I'm curious as to defining that and why many people think that would be so incredibly unpopular.
Well, and I'm not going to, Mr. Kurt, thank you for those that comment. I won't cast blame, but you can listen to this any way you want. We have demonized the term taxes so much that we can't talk about what it costs to be citizens of a civilization and a civilized country. We see in our own state the failure to face up to the cost of deteriorating infrastructure for fear that might be seen as a tax. We all of us pay taxes in one form or another. Is it a tax that I have to keep the roof on my house from leaking? I don't think so. It's just part of what my responsibility as a homeowner is. The reason we haven't talked about carbon taxes is that it is just that. They are perceived as a tax that we would all end up paying. We would end up paying the cost. Don't get me wrong. And we should. But this would be taxes on carbon, on fossil fuels at the wellhead or the minehead. And those taxes would find their way throughout the economy and change us the way we consume carbon-based fuels in many and subtle ways. But every economist who speaks to this, virtually every businessman who is thinking long-term speaks to this. This is the most efficient, least intrusive way to get us to the point where we truly account for the cost of carbon that we emit. I like to make the parallel, Rick, to, I call them carbon tipping fees. Nobody objects to the idea that if I create waste in my business, that I pay a tipping fee at the landfill. I pay for the cost of this waste. Now, since I pay per ton at the landfill, I do my best to reduce the amount of waste in my business. And I separate glass from cardboard. I do all of those things that reduce the amount of tipping fee that I have to pay. But look on carbon emissions as a tipping fee. This is a cost that's being passed on to us and the world, and the producers of that waste are not being charged for it. A carbon tipping fee just says if you're going to produce carbon waste, then you should pay the cost. And then you can, sure, pass it on to your customers. But your customers are going to say, do I want to burn coal if it's going to cost me this much? Or am I willing in the short term to pay a little more for wind power because in the long term it's going to be a lot cheaper than paying for coal? And this is how a carbon fee or carbon tipping fee or carbon tax would work with great efficiency where cap and trade or nothing doesn't work.
Al Weed here from Public Policy Virginia as we talk about carbon emissions. I see the phone is ringing. Deepak will ring it in just a minute, so let's do this.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Oh, did you know the most popular type of smoke detector doesn't actually detect smoke? Only flames, and often too late. The Hook investigates. City of Charlottesville and Albemarle County want to switch from Clorox-style cleaners to green ones. Is sanitizing acceptable versus disinfecting? And why is it more costly? Plus, pictures from the president's visit to Monticello for the annual Independence Day celebration and naturalization ceremony. The Hook, able to satisfy almost any craving. And as you probably already know, 45fix.com is the way to go if you need a simple contractor. From kitchen and bathroom remodeling, house painting to decks and siding, it's 45fix.com. Immediate, no obligation estimates available anytime. That's the number 4, the number 5, and the word fix.com. And in just 20 minutes, Drew Thompson will be here for Les Temps Perdue. If French isn't your thing around WNRN, it's The Time's Gone By, which is late 80s through 90s alternative. Tune in for it at noon. Les Temps Perdue, brought to you in part by Plan 9 Music. All right, we got a caller on line 2.
Good
caller,
morning.
Are you there? Good morning.
Hi, good morning, and thank you for the topic. Regarding biomass, I believe Brazil uses sugarcane and has for decades, and has offered to sell us biodiesel. Is that an option? And isn't corn, which the U.S. focuses on, really too thirsty a grain to be practical? I'm no farmer, but. And also about solar panels. Some couple of years ago, I saw a PBS special about solar, and they showed a flexible rubber-like bath mat solar panel that wouldn't break and worked on cloudy days and was cheaper, and I haven't heard of any other mention of this at any from any other source. So those two topics, if you could expound on those with your expertise, thank you.
Well, thank you, ma'am. The biofuel issue is an interesting one. Of course, Brazil has pretty much weaned itself from at least imported petroleum. They actually have a few oil resources, but largely because of the way they've developed their ethanol industry to the point where all cars produced there can burn 85% ethanol. Some can burn 100%, and they have made a big difference. They can sell it to us more cheaply than it's being produced in the United States, except for the 54-cent a gallon tariff that frankly is in place because of the political influence of the Midwestern farmers. Corn as a source for, and it's Brazil would be selling us ethanol, not biodiesel.
Quick question: the 54% tax. How is that not a carbon tipping fee or a carbon emissions tax?
No,
wouldn't it fall under one or the other?
No, the 54%. Actually, it is just the reverse. Ethanol imported from Brazil is a carbon neutral fuel. Therefore, it's something we should be encouraging. But in fact, there is a 54 cent a gallon tariff on that, meaning that this carbon neutral fuel costs 54 cents more per gallon than it might otherwise cost, thereby making it less attractive as a replacement. So it is just the reverse of a carbon fuel.
Back to the caller's questions.
And you're right, corn is not sustainable. The interesting thing about corn is that it at best will produce about 25% more energy than goes into it. But everyone understands that. Everyone understands that it is a thirsty crop. That's a very good word, because most of the American corn is grown on an aquifer out in the Midwest that is...
And we did a program on this, I want to say, about a year ago, about how using corn to make ethanol has actually taken food away from so many other countries.
Well, it displaces food, and there's no question about that. But keep in mind that all of the methods to produce ethanol, at least from cellulosic material, envision the end state, namely the distilleries that corn is using now. So they will be part of the process when we develop cellulosic ethanol, as will all the distribution systems. All of that will be necessary to be in place. So while corn we like to look at it as a transitional element and not a long-term solution. As to the technology in photovoltaics, you can be sure that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of new technologies out there that have people excited about producing energy. But you can also be sure that if we do not have a cap underneath energy costs, which the carbon tax is the most effective way to do that, virtually none of these will ever see the market, because they are only viable commercially when energy costs what it really costs. And until we have an assurance that carbon-based fuels are going to cost us more, we as a nation and we as individuals will not invest in this alternative technology and not bring it to the stage where it'll be widely available.
Al Weed here with Public Policy Virginia as we talk about carbon emissions. One of the last comments that the previous caller made, and feel free, dial us up, 979-0919. 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. The caller also brought up the solar panels, and I'm curious about that, as well as why people dislike those wind farms so much. They seem cheap, easy, free. I personally don't find them, and maybe this is what it comes down to, is aesthetics, and people think that they look ugly, so that's why we can't use them. But I'd like you to get into the solar panels and then follow that up with the wind farms.
Well, the technology in solar panels is improving dramatically. I'm not an expert on solar. I have an advisor who keeps me up to date on it. One of the things that's happened, even at the limited use in the United States relative to the potential, is we have perhaps reached the end of free silicon. The silicon that goes into current photovoltaic production is the waste material from the silicon that's used in computer chip manufacturing. And as long as it's waste material, it is at a relatively low cost. If we push up the demand for photovoltaics, we have to push it up in a big way to create our own or that industry's own process to produce silicon. And so we're in some economic constraint points. We'll get beyond it as demand changes. But in the short term, it's not a gradual, smooth curve. There will be some bumps in it. And I think these various kinds of solar technology are going to be tested in the marketplace, and they're already finding acceptance. The issue of wind technology, but the deeper issue is, and I think it goes to part of the politics of this, Rick, and I don't mean in this case partisan politics at all. We as a nation consume more energy per capita than any country in the world.
Lots of things fall into that.
Yeah.
Food and
you name it.
We can name a dozen things.
And just so that our listeners feel as comfortable with this fact as I am, we consume in Virginia twice as much per capita as they do in California.
In energy?
In energy, yes. We are an energy prolific state.
Is that a recent trend since the last couple governors in California have made sincere and severe efforts
to reduce their energy? It's 25 years of reducing energy use in California versus ignoring it in Virginia. And there's some serious problems with that if we have time to get into. So we're consuming all of this energy. We want our lifestyle. We want our air conditioners. We want our computers. We want our radios and all of that. But we're not willing, all of us, to share in the cost of new alternative technology in the sense of how it will impact our own environment. So you have all kinds of arguments against nuclear technology, but nuclear technology doesn't emit greenhouse gases. I'm not making a case for it, but I am saying it has to be part of the mix. The clearest case, the aesthetics case in the wind farms in Highland County in Virginia, I think is a good example of we are asking the people in Highland County, which has right around 5,000 people, to make sacrifices in terms of aesthetics and perhaps their concern about flying wildlife, bats and birds, to make sacrifices there so you and I can enjoy air conditioning on this 90-degree day. Why don't we have a system that recognizes that in a locality there are sacrifices that are going to be made and that we reward them for that? So I would say if you are in Highland County within visual sight of that wind farm, you should get a reduction in your electric bill. You're paying for something in your aesthetic life. Why shouldn't you get a compensation for that? We are not losing anything aesthetically in this region from that electricity, but ultimately we will be getting more affordable energy. So a system that, and I actually talked to somebody at Dominion Power about this, and it could happen. You can envision all kinds of ways where the not in my backyard syndrome would be countered by, but because it's going to be in your backyard, here's what you get for it. And we can all then make our own trade-offs.
11:48 on the Sunday morning wake-up call here at WNRN. And it doesn't matter whether you're listening in Levinson's 94.7 or Charlottesville's 91.9, you're free to call us up, 979-0919. Hal Weed, Chairman of Public Policy Virginia, talking about carbon emissions and a little bit strayed into other environmental topics with solar panels and
wind power.
Wind power. It's just that simple. You'd think I could remember that. I read a piece that you had done in regards to the Lieberman-Warner bill. And I'm curious if you'll take a moment to explain rather simply what that bill was about. And you had said that you thought it was incorrect but still important.
Well, to go back to our initial discussion about cap and trade, I think cap and trade is will in the end be a rather ineffectual way to reduce carbon emissions. I'm a big proponent of carbon fees. Just because I think they take advantage of the market so much better. And I'm not alone in this, thank goodness, but I may be alone in that I'm not running for office so I can talk about carbon fees. The cap and trade bill, the Warner-Lieberman bill that was introduced, and there are other versions of it, was an effort to avoid the word tax. And so here was a system that would cap carbon emissions primarily at power-producing plants and then create a market for the pollution rights in the short term, so that if you had a polluting a power plant, you would have to buy the right to continue to pollute for a certain number of years until you could reduce that pollution. That money would then go into the government coffers, and obviously the cost of that would be passed on to the consumer. And so how that could not be a tax is totally, totally beyond me, but that's how it was described. The reason why I am afraid of the Warner-Lieberman bill or cap and trade is that to move us in any direction, and this is why it's important, to move us in any direction is going to take a serious national conversation. It doesn't appear that we're ready for it yet at the level of the Senate, but we absolutely have to do it, and we have to do it soon. I was afraid that if we moved ahead with the Warner-Lieberman bill and actually got something, its fundamental weaknesses would in about 10 years become so obvious to all of us that we would have to start the debate all over again. Generally speaking, I am not a proponent of the best in favor of the good, but in this case, cap and trade is a dead end that won't do much to solve global warming and doesn't get to the transportation issues at all. But the mere fact that the Senate was finally ready, at least appeared to be ready, to debate serious legislation regarding carbon emissions was a significant step forward. Too bad it didn't go very far.
All right, we do have a call. Jason, how are you?
Doing good, how are you?
Hey, where are you from?
Living in Greenville.
All right, Greenville. Hey, that's a good word for the day. Question or comment?
One question and one comment, I guess. About the wind power, would there be, what kind of grants are out there for people who, you know, you're talking about, you don't, people don't want to have a windmill in Highland County to supply electricity for, you know, me out here in Greenville. What about wind co-oping for like a community of houses that, you know, maybe one guy's got a great hill and you can share that electricity in a neighborhood? Would that be the most sustainable way to maybe take advantage of wind power? And my second question is, what kind of grants and things are out there for somebody, if any, would want to start like a solar power company? There's nothing like that, you know, here in the valley, and it's been on my mind for a while, and today's program has really kind of got me going.
Hey, that's what we want to do, man. Get you thinking. Thanks for calling. Can you listen on the radio to the answer?
Yes, sir.
All right, thank you. Fire away, Al.
I think, Jason, what you're talking to is the sort of thing that the market will push as people look around them and say, you know, we can do this. We don't need government to tell us how to do it, and we don't need Dominion Power to tell us how to do it. We can decentralize our energy production. There are companies, I don't know that any of them have fully gotten to the market, that essentially want to rent your rooftop to put photovoltaics on it and then sell that excess power to the power company and maintain your rooftop and the whole works. That has a real commercial potential. Local wind farms, small-scale wind farms, have probably some potential. The problem is the really efficient turbines are, the towers themselves are like 250 feet high, and then you've got a 300-foot diameter windmill on it, and they're very expensive. And the cost of installing them would strike me to be a bit out of the range of the average community to do it. We don't have any good grants on decentralized, that I'm aware of, on any on decentralized power production yet. We have some tax credits. There are some advantages that come in your taxes from putting in alternative energy, but you have to have money to pay taxes on, and you have to have a tax bill before that pays off. I think we're a bit away from that. I think that more likely that you're going to see companies coming to you and say, let me use your rooftop. Companies coming to you saying, I will rent your unused farmland to create biomass so I can produce ethanol from it. We'll see lots of ways that this works it out in time.
All right. The hour is winding down, 11:54 here on the Wake Up Call, but we do have time, if you'd like to make a call or make a comment, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS, Al Weed from Public Policy, Virginia. You are also listening to WNRS FM Sweetbriar, Amherst, Virginia. Al, this question came in. Jeff from Lovingston didn't want to go on air. About 30,000 scientists came to the conclusion last year that there is no global warming. Please explain.
Well, you have to kind of look at the list of people who are defined as scientists in that group. They include physicians and people whose whose expertise in climate change or climatology is minimal or non-existent.
Yes, but the former, one of the former scientists, maybe he's still a current professor at the University of Virginia, who was the state climatologist, came to that conclusion.
A number of people have, yet the overwhelming scientific community, like 97%, has come to the opposite conclusion that there is climate change and there is global warming. I don't think that anybody can deny global warming. In the last 10 years, 8 of the last 10 have been the warmest we've ever recorded in history. They're now predicting that the Arctic, or the polar ice cap in the north, will be ice-free next summer for the first time since humanity knows anything about this. So global warming is a fact. That cannot be denied. What is still being debated, I think unproductively, but it will not stop, is whether mankind's use of fossil fuel is contributing to this warming. And as a military person, I love this observation that a general who waits for 100% of the facts to be in before he acts is a defeated general. As a nation, if we wait for 100% of assurance that we are causing this, it will be absolutely too late. The evidence is very, very strong. The amount of CO2 in the air is higher than ever in the world, in the history of the world, to the extent that we can look at ice caps that go back 20 and 30,000 years in Greenland. We know that this is related to our use of carbon fuels, and the conclusions are inescapable.
All right, just a few minutes left. I see Deepak is on the phone with someone. Hopefully we can get that call or question on air. 11:57 here with Al Weed. You know, we talked about from Brazil and their new neutral carbon fees. How do we remove those?
Well, again,
what makes the 54 cents go away?
That's politics. You could argue that the need for a 50 cent a gallon tax credit, which is what ethanol producers get, has pretty much disappeared with gas at $4 a gallon. But unfortunately, in most of these sort of special interest fees and incentives, they have a life of their own. The whole game of carbon credits that farmers can get, they have a value, they have an economic value, but they don't, you know, they're not really paying off in ways that encourage the right kind of farming, and would be put out of business by carbon taxes. So one of the things that cap and trade does is continue what amount to uneconomic incentives to get us to the end point. But a lot of this is going to be, and it always will be, politics and who has the biggest clout and who has the biggest microphone.
All right, we're going to finish up the show. I've seen the phone ring 3 times in the last 3 minutes. The program will be podcast, www.cvillepodcast.com. Sean Tubbs, I'll get him to leave that open for comments so you can go on. If you want to ask a question to Al, I'll refer them along. But www.cvillepodcast.com. I apologize to John on the phone line, but there's just not enough time left. Where were you people at 11:10? If you're finishing your church hour, well, there you go. Al, thank you so much for joining us today.
Good to be here, Rick.
And I think that we'll need to do this again.
I'd love to.
All right. Al Weed, Chairman, Public Policy, Virginia. And Adios, until next week.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon Gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@aol.com or at wnrn.org. The wake-up call is produced by Michael Strickland. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the wake-up call, only on WNRN.
ninety one nine WNRN at